Well, I want to welcome you and thank you very much for coming to what I am confident will be quite an interesting set of presentations on the interesting topic itself of binational approaches to immigrant integration. We've built the session in some ways around two papers, which I believe are on your chair, that we are releasing and have released. One focuses on innovative programs in binational education that involve Mexico and that involve Spain, and that respond to a number of different phenomena, but one of the phenomena it really responds to is the very tough, abiding issue of finding enough good teachers to teach the large English language learner K through 12 population in the United States. As many of you have probably heard me say before, 1 in 10 kids in K through 12 education system in the United States is an English language learner, and of those, 1/2 are Mexican origin. So one paper is on the education, on these educational strategies, and then a second paper focuses more broadly on Mexico's consular offices and on the Institute for Mexicans Abroad, and the evolution of the mission of these offices beyond the sort of the conventional role of consular offices in the United States to provide protection, an evolution beyond that to include the deep mission of the integration of immigrants into the U.S. Now, the conversation and our work today proceed from basically two points of departure. The first, which Kathleen Newland has drummed into my head eventually, is that integration and development are absolutely integrally linked. Because successful immigrants, a successful diaspora in the end, will in the end send more back home, fill the coffers more widely, and be more successful upon return. The second point of departure for this project and for these papers, and it's the germ of the papers really from the start, is that we've contended that Mexico's consular offices represent some of the most important immigrant integrating institutions within the United States. And as you'll hear, they work in a wide range of areas that range from health to education, to leadership development, to civic engagement, to financial literacy, and they're going to be moving in very interesting directions, as the ambassador will be discussing. But we also contend that their role as immigrant integrating institutions in the society is generally too little known and too little understood, and that they might offer quite interesting and important examples and models for other sending and receiving countries. This is all part and parcel of our work here at MPI and our National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, which I, Michael Fix, and Margie McHugh, who is here, we co-direct the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. And part of what we're doing, which is involved, which relates to this, is we're trying to map this kind of inchoate field of immigrant integration, and we're trying to identify what works and what doesn't work. And, of course, these programs have a deep, deep, powerful, if obvious to all of us, demographic logic. I'll just give you my three favorite factoids, which is 1 in 10 Mexicans lives in the United States. And here's my new factoid, which I like very much, which is 1 in 10 children under the age of 18 in the United States has a parent who was born in Mexico. And of course, almost all Mexican emigrants come to the United States. 96% of Mexican emigrants go to the United States. So, stepping back, this conversation is from an MPI perspective. This conversation lies very much at the intersection of two of our bodies of work, our work on immigration and our work on migration and development. And so with that, let me briefly introduce the panel and give you a map of the session. Our first speaker will be Lorene Lag-Legarin, who's going to set the stage for the conversation. She's going to give us a broad overview of the integration roles that are played by consular offices, by the Institute for Mexicans Abroad, and she's going to say a word about the evolution of these programs over time. Loreen is a lawyer. She's a graduate of the UCLA Law School. She's also a graduate of the Urban Institute's immigration program. And she leads our work here, our important work here, on language access, and has been instrumental in our work on the controversial 287G program that we're working on. We're then going to hear from our own young Aaron Taratsis, a policy analyst here at the Migration Policy Institute. He'll be talking about binational strategies in the area of education. For those of you who've been following our work recently, Aaron has been central to our work on the impact of the recession on migration and migrants worldwide. And then I'm delighted to say we are going to get the vital perspective of Ambassador Carlos Garcia de Alba, who is the Director General for the Institute for Mexicans Abroad, who has extremely generously agreed to be with us today. The ambassador has had an extremely distinguished career. He's previously served as the Director General of the International Affairs in Mexico's Ministry of Public Education. He was the Consul General in Texas, and this is just some of his many prominent posts. And then I should also add that he has received a PhD in sociology from the University of Rome, making him one of the most successful and worldly sociologists that I know. Finally, Kathleen Newland, MPI's co-founder, board member, and a director of our very successful program on migrants, migration, and development, is going to place the work on consular offices and on the IME within a development context and talk and discuss a little bit about other nations' experiences through that context setting. Let me note before we begin that the ambassador has requested that his remarks and that his responses this morning are off the record, which we, that is to say all of us, will be happy to accommodate. However, the comments of all the other presenters, for better or for worse, will be very much on the record. And then finally, I just want to take this opportunity to thank the Tinker Foundation in New York, who sponsored this work, for their unswerving support over the 2 years it took to get it done. So with that, let me turn the floor over to Loreen Lagley-Garin, and we'll get going.
Great. Thank you, Michael. Good morning to all of you. In addition to thanking the Tinker Foundation for making this work possible, I'd also like to thank Ambassador Garcia de Alba and his staff at the Institute for Mexicans Abroad, or IME, for providing exceptional access to administrative data, program staff, and program reports. So thank you, Mr. Ambassador. And as I thank him, I also have to apologize in advance for my mispronunciation of Spanish, of the Spanish language, which I will inevitably do during this presentation. So for that, I apologize in advance. As Michael has mentioned, there are distinct facts that animate the Mexican government's initiatives in immigrant integration. 10% of Mexicans live in the United States, and the United States remains the destination of choice for most Mexican immigrants. In addition to the concentration of Mexican immigrants in the United States, Mexico's geographic proximity to the United States enables the existence of a truly shared population between the United States and Mexico. When we first started to examine Mexico's programs for its migrants, it was hard not to be struck by the unique role played by Mexican consular staff and Mexico's strategy towards its population in the United States. Here was a situation where an immigrant-sending country was helping its migrants integrate into a receiving country. Here was a situation where our typical ideas of consular service, namely diplomacy, possibly the issuance of travel documents, was extended towards social service provision. And although relatively new and small in scale, here was an ambitious program that sought to comprehensively address the migrants' needs through initiatives in healthcare, education, financial literacy, and civic education. IME's programs offer a wide range of integration initiatives unparalleled by any other sending country in the United States. During this presentation, my colleague Arian and I will discuss the demographic profile of Mexican immigrants and how that profile can pose challenges to immigrant integration, the evolution in the role and function of Mexican consular staff and offices, the overall structure and funding of IME, and finally, we'll provide a brief overview of key IME initiatives. Since 1980, immigrants from Mexico have been the largest single immigrant group in the United States, with just under 12 million Mexican foreign-born residing here. 83% of Mexican foreign-born live in just 10 states. This accounts for almost a third of the entire U.S. foreign-born population. Mexican immigrants face adjustment challenges if they are recent arrivals, limited English proficient, or have lower educational attainment. Almost a third of all Mexican immigrants in the United States arrived in 2000 or later. Nearly three quarters of Mexican immigrants self-reported that they spoke English less than very well, and as a result were classified as limited English proficient. And three in five Mexican immigrants have no high school degree. Healthcare access and coverage remain low. Since 1996, non-citizens have limited access to public benefits, and unauthorized immigrants are eligible for few benefits beyond emergency Medicaid. Poor English proficiency, low educational attainment, lack of health care, recency of arrival, and unauthorized immigrant status not only isolates Mexican immigrants, but complicates efforts to deliver services that support their integration. In part as a response to the needs of its migrants in the United States, the Mexican government, through IME, began an effort to create localized programs geared specifically to improving the social and human capital of its nationals in the United States. But the evolution towards immigrant integration at the consular level must be seen in tandem with larger efforts by the Mexican government to formally engage its citizens in the United States. Historically, there was very little formal engagement, at least at the federal level. Certainly, some hometown associations established relationships with their home Mexican states, but by and large, formal federal level outreach initiatives did not happen until the early 1990s. Academics identify five factors that drive formal efforts to engage the Mexican diaspora in the United States. First, the legalization of 3 million unauthorized immigrants, many of whom were Mexican nationals. This created a different type of relationship between the Mexican government and its citizens. As now lawful permanent residents on the path towards U.S. citizenship, the needs of Mexican immigrants extended further than those of temporary workers. Mexican LPRs needed help with long-term social and economic incorporation, including assistance with learning English, finding healthcare, and integrating into the U.S. labor force. By the early 1990s, it was evident that Mexican immigrants could be influential in Mexican politics, as seen by their opposition to the ruling PRI during the 1998 presidential campaign. Moreover, when expatriates obtained the right to vote in September 2005, the political reality became one in which migrants yielded considerable influence. Mexicans also had to be more proactive in defending anti-immigrant attacks on Mexicans and Mexican-Americans, such as California's Proposition 187. This proposition prevented unauthorized immigrants from seeking social services, health care, and public education in California, and was later ruled unconstitutional. Pragmatically, the Mexican government likely understood the necessity of maintaining a strong economic connection with Mexican immigrants to ensure a steady stream of remittances and investment opportunities. And lastly, the Mexican government certainly aspired to establish a significant Mexican-American presence in the United States that could potentially benefit U.S.-Mexico relations. By 2003, under the leadership of former President Vicente Fox, two migrant-serving organizations were merged to form IME, the Institute for Mexicans Abroad. IME is an independent department within the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. It works through 56 consular offices in the United States and Canada, seen in the dots and triangles. At each consular office, there are between one and five community affairs staff charged with carrying out IME's mission. Approximately 75 of these IME representatives conduct their work through the consular offices, with approximately 40 staff remaining at IME headquarters in Mexico City. All staff working within IME are employees of the Mexican Foreign Ministry and can include members of the Mexican Foreign Service as well as local hires. So how much does Mexico invest in IME? The answer is surprisingly modest. In 2009, the ministry allocated 6% or $24 million of its total budget of $387 million to services for Mexicans abroad, Of that 24 million, only 2.8 million was directed to IME. Of course, this figure does not take into account the salaries of IME staff, but more importantly, it does not include matching funds and in-kind donations individual consulates and programs may receive from Mexican businesses, private individuals, nonprofit organizations, or government entities. Therefore, it can be difficult to assign an exact figure on the amount of money it takes to run IME programs. IME has set in motion a range of immigrant integration practices to help Mexican immigrants succeed in the United States. Programs focus on civic education, healthcare, and financial literacy, and are often joint initiatives between IME and other governmental entities. For example, the Binational Teacher Exchange that Aaron will probably talk about later on today is an initiative by IME, the Secretariat of Public Education, and the Secretariat of Foreign Relations on the Mexican side. On the U.S. side, partners can include U.S. state departments, local school districts, and local school districts who are in need of bilingual teachers. I'm going to quickly cover key IME initiatives in civic education, healthcare, and financial literacy this morning before I turn it over to Aaron to discuss education. One of IME's signature initiatives is in the area of civic engagement. So why civic engagement? Faced with the reality that Mexicans and their descendants have long encountered discrimination in the United States, IME sought to reduce anti-Mexican sentiment by developing leadership within the Mexican immigrant community and encouraging their participation in the political process. One effort was the Mexican Migrant Advisory Council. The Mexican Migrant Advisory Council is an elected council voted into office by Mexican migrants themselves. The council meets twice a year in Mexico City or the United States and discusses healthcare, political issues, legal matters, education, media, business, and border issues. Council members serve three-year terms and cannot be reelected, and I believe we have one former council member in the audience. They are not considered public servants and receive no compensation for their work. However, IME may occasionally pay for their travel and accommodation. The first 2003-2005 council was made up of approximately 100 advisors, 10 representatives from Mexican American or Latino organizations, 10 special advisors, as well as representatives from Mexico's 32 state governments. The process of electing council members differs by consular office, but the council itself issues models for election administration. Consulists may host elections, but consular and government staff are explicitly excluded from the process of administering the election. Migrants and their descendants are nominated or self-nominated for consideration. So the council itself issues hundreds of recommendations to the Mexican government. The first cohort issued 255 recommendations. IME staff must reply to each recommendation, and if a response is outside of IME's purview, it will be directed to the appropriate ministry to respond. Past recommendations have included the need to increase consular capabilities, a desire for the council to forge relationships with higher-level ministry staff, and the need for a more proactive approach to fighting anti-immigrant initiatives under consideration in the United States. Some former council members were also active in the spring 2006 demonstrations across the U.S. protesting congressional attempts to make illegal immigration a felony. Council members can be highly critical of Mexican migrant initiatives and openly voice their concern. And though they may criticize the Mexican government, they participate in a structured process that allows concerns to travel to the appropriate ministry. Participation in the council builds leadership within the diaspora and establishes a mechanism for Mexican immigrants to better advocate for their needs in both ascending and receiving country. Organizations that focus on civic and cultural activities are more likely to promote the incorporation of immigrants into the American political system. This concept is best illustrated by the example of Luz Robles, a former council member who in 2008 was elected state senator in Utah. Why health? IME has also prioritized safeguarding the health and well-being of Mexican migrants in the United States, 56% of whom are not covered by health insurance and 47% of whom do not have access to regular medical care. Mexican immigrants are less likely than African Americans and non-Hispanic whites to have early cervical, breast, or colon cancer screening, and along with African Americans have the highest admission rates to hospitals due to complications from uncontrolled diabetes. Given their limited access to quality preventive or curative health care, IMEI has focused on improving migrant health care in the United States. One of IMEI's hallmark programs in the area of health is its consular health stations, or ventanillas de salud. Begun in 2003 as pilot projects in Los Angeles and San Diego, ventanillas were a joint project between IMEI, the California Endowment, and the U.S. Border Health Commission. Ventanillas, or offices, are offices or kiosks within Mexican consulates that provide Mexican migrants with a gateway to local health care services. Aimed at providing on-site assistance and outreach to low-income Mexican migrants unfamiliar with the U.S. health system, health stations have three main goals: to provide health care referrals and appointments, to enroll eligible adults and children in federal, state, and local public health programs, and to provide information on health issues relevant to the Mexican migrant community. IMEI regional staff do not provide any of the health care services directly. Instead, IMEI works with a local sponsoring nonprofit organization to develop and establish a ventanilla. The partnering nonprofit organization manages the day-to-day operations and can offer a variety of services depending on community needs. In 2008, ventanillas helped 38,000 individuals establish a medical home or find an appropriate health center, community clinic, or public hospital. Ventanillas performed a little over 17,000 diagnostic tests, including those for diabetes, cholesterol, HIV/AIDS, as well as blood pressure testing and vaccinations. As the national coordinator of the Ventanilla program, IMEI has developed program guidelines and collects uniform program evaluation and reports. IMEI also brings Ventanilla staff together periodically to learn from each other and exchange resources. IMEI provides some funding from the Mexican Health Ministry, approximately $460,000 in 2007, but as with other IMEI programs, these funds are combined with funds from a fiscal sponsor or nonprofit organization. Touching briefly on IMEI's initiatives in the financial arena, as you can imagine, the size of Mexican migrants' financial contributions is significant. In 2008, migrant remittances to Mexico through formal channels totaled $26 billion, or 3% of the country's GDP. With the average monthly remittance around $300, given the volume and magnitude of remittances and other financial contributions, it's unsurprising that IMEI's economic programs have sought to promote banking among Mexican migrants and to provide them access to financial services, allowing them to increase the share of their incomes that they keep and to establish a secure place to keep their money in the United States. IMEI also disseminates information about low-cost alternatives for sending money to Mexico. They support programs that give remittances additional value by matching, and in some case tripling, investments in Mexico. And they organize programs and projects that take advantage of the knowledge and experience of highly qualified entrepreneurial migrants who can invest in or become partners with Mexican corporations. And with that, I'll turn it over to Aaron to discuss IMEI's education initiatives.
Great. Thank you, Lorraine. Now, just so no one here thinks that I'm getting off easy, I wanted to remind everyone that Ambassador Garcia de Alba was actually responsible for all of the education ministry's programs for migrants abroad before moving over to IMEI. So I trust he'll be equally as vigilant in monitoring the quality of my presentation as well. First of all, I guess I want, why focus on education? Why are we dedicating an extra kind of particular focus to this issue? If you're here, it's probably obvious, but let me just highlight a couple of particular issues. First, socioeconomic mobility. Studies repeatedly show that there's a high degree of relationship between parents and children's educational and then labor market and income later in life. Julia Isaacs from the Brookings Institution recently estimated that about 4 of every 10 children born in the bottom quintile of U.S. households by income remain there over their lifetimes. Studies from Mexico show that about 50% of any child's chances of moving up, or I should say 50% of children remain in the same income quintile as their parents in Mexico. So education obviously is a big driver of whether students move up or students or children kind of stay the same. Another important issue is changing U.S. labor market demand, particularly right now in the context of the recession that, you know, both of our countries have been experiencing. I think there's a growing awareness that the jobs of the future are going to require some degree of a post-secondary education. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics recently released new projections of occupational demand in the United States for the 2008 to 18 period. And they show that about 3 of every 10 jobs in 2008 in the United States required some form of post-secondary credential, education, et cetera. Over the next 10 years, half of all new jobs will require that level of education. Mexico, too, is facing kind of similar demands on its education system, particularly as it faces competition from places like Asia for in industries that are low-skill labor-intensive. Finally, another reason why education is important is new communities. Mexicans have increasingly moved to new places in the United States over the past 2 decades, settling particularly in the Midwest and southern United States. And this has placed new kind of stresses on educational systems that are not traditionally accustomed to receiving and integrating immigrants. You know, California and New York may have 100 years of experience integrating immigrants, but the places like North Carolina or Georgia may not have that long of a period. So there's certainly a learning curve there. And before continuing, I should also recognize that both governments kind of appear to recognize this importance of education. You know, Michael's previous research has shown that the No Child Left Behind Act of 2001 put in place requirements that school districts show that they're teaching limited English proficient students. Similarly, education is a big focus of EMA's work across the board, as Laureen's chart showed. And actually, as far back as 1990, the two governments signed a memorandum of understanding on education that outlined several areas where there was potential for cooperation. And if we look down on the state level, cooperation in California, between California and the Mexican state of Michoacan, dates back to the 1970s. So this is something that they've been aware of for a long time and have actually been working together substantively for quite a while. That said, there are a number of educational challenges still remaining. I highlight a couple here, particularly low English proficiency. About 43% of Mexican-born children and 77% of Mexican-born adults have difficulty speaking English. This is a huge impediment to getting service jobs or kind of moving up in the labor force. Low educational attainment, about a third of Latinos in general drop out of U.S. high schools. This is much higher than dropout rates for non-Latino students. And when we look at the adult population, kind of nearly two-thirds of Mexican-born adults age 25 or older lack a high school diploma or an equivalent, compared to just 21% of non-Mexican immigrants. And finally, kind of a third point that I'd like to underline is high residential mobility. There's been a number of studies, particularly from Victor Zuniga, who is the Dean of Education at the University of Monterrey in Mexico, who show that a number of students actually have educational careers that go back and forth across both countries. You know, this is a historical pattern that's been traditionally observed along the U.S.-Mexico border, and I guess has diminished somewhat in recent years, but still, Professor Zuniga estimates that about 1.6 million students in Mexican elementary and secondary schools have at some point in their academic careers enrolled in U.S. schools. Obviously, beyond the differences of curriculum and content, I just wanted to highlight this kind of rather confusing chart, which shows the differences between the two education systems. A student may enroll in elementary school in Mexico, but then jump to middle school and then back to elementary school, depending on how frequently they move. And the red box actually shows kind of where education is required in the two countries. So now let me go a bit into EMA's education programs, some of the things that Laureen was talking about. I'm going to focus on three different kind of groups of programs. First, programs that help these mobile students who move back and forth or change their residence frequently, programs that help this population succeed in school. then secondly, I'm going to focus on programs that help build capacity in new communities. And finally, I'm going to focus on kind of an emerging set of initiatives that aim to promote post-secondary and adult education in particular. As far as programs that help mobile students succeed, probably the most important is the Binational Migrant Education Program. Now, migrant students, as defined in the education lingo, is a very limited subset of the total U.S. student population. They are students who must have changed residence within the past 36 months due to the agricultural or other seasonal occupations of their parents. So this includes the children of agricultural workers, as well as so the children of people who work in fishing, some extractive industries as well. And binational students, on top of that, must have moved between the U.S. and Mexico. The program aims to broadly disrupt the aims to minimize the disruptions in a student's academic career caused by this movement. They provide a number of supportive services that can include concentrated and intensive instruction to provide supplemental academic courses that students may have missed during the year. They provide remedial instruction in reading and math in particular, and where necessary, English as a second language. They include dropout prevention, sometimes vocational training or college counseling, as well as cultural activities and sports. And finally, in some cases, they provide health counseling, transportation, meals, and parental outreach. And I should mention that this Binational Migrant Education Program is actually a partnership with the U.S. Department of Education, their Office of Migrant Education, which plays a big role partnering with Mexico's federal and state education ministries. Secondly, the Binational Student Transfer Document. Now, this is kind of, when we first came across this, we were surprised that this little piece of paper, which is, you know, one document, could actually matter so much. But for students who move back and forth, this document contains their kind of the courses that they've taken, you know, any exams, what grade levels they've completed, and so really is vital for school districts on both sides of the border. A problem that students who move frequently often face is that upon moving, you know, students, the schools won't be able to exactly place, they won't understand what courses they've taken, and it'll be difficult to place them in appropriate courses. So initiatives like the Binational Student Transfer Document can really contribute to minimizing kind of waste and delays in placing students. Finally, I'm going to focus on the short-term teacher exchanges, which occur under the Binational Migrant Education Program, which are essentially Mexican teachers who volunteer to work with migrant students in the U.S. For a short period of time, typically 3 weeks to 3 months, often over the summer. They work directly with students, sometimes with the U.S. teachers of migrant students, providing support for teachers or helping develop curriculum. I remember I spoke with one educator from California who noted that these volunteer teachers from Mexico were really actually indispensable because California has a substantial population of Mexican students of indigenous origin who don't necessarily speak Spanish as their original language. And California doesn't have, you know, bilingual teachers in indigenous languages, and these teachers were able to provide those services. Speaking on the second kind of broad topic of building K-12 capacity in emerging communities, I'll focus on the longer-term teacher exchanges, which I also discuss, Michael and I discussed in the other paper that you should have on your seats. These are exchanges that occur over, you know, anywhere from 1 to 3 years. They occur actually within the framework of the Mutual Educational and Cultural Exchange Act, more commonly known as the Fulbright Act. And U.S. school districts are able to hire directly Mexican teachers for short-term periods. We identified these programs as particularly useful in communities where there's been a rapid change in student populations, or where kind of language capacities need to be quickly developed. We only looked at the example of Mexico and Spain, which also has similar programs, but something that occurred to us is that similar exchanges could be useful for rapid inflows of refugee populations. For example, the inflow of Iraqi refugees may be something to consider. A second kind of much smaller program is the distribution of Spanish language textbooks to school districts, libraries, and community centers across the United States. Research repeatedly shows that students who are limited English proficient have better academic outcomes when they receive academic instruction paired with language instruction. A common approach is to just focus on language instruction, which can delay a student's academic progress. But by pairing the two types of instruction, students actually advance faster and are able to both learn English and maintain their math skills, maintain their science skills, etc. These textbooks, which have academic content in Spanish, can be particularly useful for that. And I think the latest statistics that I saw were in about 2007, about 10,000 books were donated to schools, libraries, et cetera, in the United States. Finally, promoting post-secondary and adult education. As I mentioned, these are kind of a number of small emerging programs, but as I mentioned in the introduction, are going to be increasingly important because of changing labor demands and et cetera. First, let me focus on kind of a number of Mexican universities who have either established satellite campuses or outreach or programs for Mexicans in the United States. Most notably, the National Autonomous University of Mexico has developed a distance education program for Mexicans in the United States so they can obtain their secondary degrees, their Mexican secondary degrees, which would then allow them to continue into U.S. community colleges, workforce training programs, et cetera. Another program recently launched by the University of Guadalajara aims to establish kind of a cultural center in Los Angeles, which will provide kind of cultural programming for the time being. Second, let me point to a number of initiatives on credential translation and alignment. IME is working with the University of California at Los Angeles, the University of Texas at Austin, and the City University of New York to develop a kind of a translation mechanism that would correlate courses that students take in Mexican upper secondary education with their equivalent courses in the United States. If successful, you know, as I mentioned, this would allow students to more smoothly transition from secondary to post-secondary education. A third issue are these community learning centers, or in Spanish as they're known, plazas comunitarias. These are a number of partnerships with community-based organizations that offer educational programs for migrants age 15 or older. The programs include Spanish language and literacy, kind of elementary and lower secondary education equivalency, computer literacy courses as well. And they're actually open to non-Mexicans as well. And from what I understand, they've served a number of Central American immigrants in the past. There are about close to 400 plazas operating in about 35 states. A recent a 2007 estimate from the Mexican National Institute of Adult Education that I saw estimated that they served about 17,000 students in total. So, I mean, it's a relatively small program compared to, you know, U.S. adult language and education program, but still, it's an important option for people who may have no other option. Another kind of category is distance upper secondary education, and I covered that I think briefly with the UNAM program. Finally, since my time is running out, let me mention a few things about vocational training and career ladders. These programs have been kind of very small, limited to, you know, a handful of examples in I think three sites, but it's kind of an interesting example that merits further examination. IME has worked, for example, with Mexican migrants, I know in the dairy sector in Wisconsin, to provide additional training which would allow these migrants to, you know, advance into higher categories of occupations that eventually allow them to earn, you know, a couple more dollars an hour, which makes a very big difference. And from what I understand, and please correct me if I'm mistaken, there's other programs on for restaurant and hospitality workers in Los Angeles and Chicago, the last I read. So having gone over my time, I'll pass the word on to Ambassador.
Good morning. And thank you. I want to thank, first of all, to the MPI for this very kind invitation, for allowing me to be this morning here. Thank you so much once again, and please, Michael and Kathleen, send my best regards to Dr. Papadimitri. It's a pity not to meet him today, but I know that he's so busy and, I don't know, somewhere in this big planet.
Davos, I'm afraid.
And I want to recognize both Laureen and Aaron for this very interesting and complete papers. They really made a tremendous job. They made a very serious, deep, professional investigation, and they were able to summarize very complicated networking programs in just a few pages. So really, thank you so much. And this is also a good opportunity to remember and to honor the good memory of of Ambassador Carlos Rico, who, as you know, unfortunately, recently, just 3 weeks ago, passed away. Ambassador Rico was really supportive, and he was fully involved in this kind of investigations and works. And also, let me recognize my antecessor, Consul General Carlos González Gutiérrez, who is now the Consul General of Mexico in Sacramento, and who was also very committed in order to make possible these two research and studies. What I want to do with my time, instead of going in full detail with these two papers, because there are some things that we need to possibly to adjust, or I may say even better, to update just few cases. Laureen speaks about some numbers. She says around 10% of Mexicans live abroad. We estimate that is around 11%. That 1% means something like 500,000 people. So we need to think a little bit and to update this kind of information. And it's not just a case, because possibly you are aware, but the Mexican diaspora is the third largest diaspora in the world, just immediately after the Indian. That is the biggest, this is the largest, the second is the Chinese, and the Mexican is the third. But you have to remember the size of the Indian and Chinese population and the Mexican one. So in speaking about percentages, by far the Mexican diaspora is the most important worldwide. So that's the reason, because I think we need to discuss, to adjust a little bit these figures. But there are some important updatings, like in the case of the health, can you hear me? Yes. Like in the case of the health stations. Last year, when Laureen was working this paper, we had 30 health stations already opened, working permanently. Now we have 42. So in just 1 year, we were able to open 12 more health stations. It speaks of a very successful and interesting program that the Mexican government, through the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, have been able to promote and to consolidate. So, if you don't mind, I take advantage of my time in order to focus in a completely different thing. You are very aware that this year, 2010, is a very special year for Mexico, and not just for Mexico, for several countries in Latin America. This is the year of the bicentennial of the beginning of the war of independence, and in the case of Mexico, it's also the anniversary, the centennial of the starting of the Mexican Revolution. But there is also a third anniversary that is, I think, important to remember and to share with you. This is the 20th anniversary of the beginning of the very first permanent program for Mexicans abroad. Just in 1990, the Mexican government decided to start working permanently through a federal program with Mexicans abroad. So this coming April, specifically and exactly the 21st of April, we will celebrate this important anniversary in Mexico City. We will be able to invite and to gather interesting people who were involved at the very beginning of this tremendous initiative. And we will have the opportunity to invite some academicians, officials from both sides, the US and Mexico, in order to analyze, to make a full, deep checkup of what is the situation and where are we standing after 20 years of working with this important program. So I take this opportunity to share with you some very frank, open thoughts in three specific fields. The first one, to remember again and again what are the original objectives of Instituto Los Mexicanos en el Exterior. There are many, but I want to focus on those that are, for me, the most important. The second part is what have been the real achievements of IME. Not those that have a kind of achievements, those that we really think we have been able to achieve fully. And the third and last part, what's next? What is the next step we need to move on? What are the strategic challenges the Mexican government, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Instituto Los Mexicanos en el Exterior have with this program, with these public policies, with Mexicans abroad? So let me start remembering these three main objectives. The first one, to design public policies that promote effective and sustainable improvement of living standards of migrants and their families. This is, I think, is obvious. It's even, let's say, a common sense thing. What I want to stress is that we need to start working more with families. Typically, we were working with a stereotype of Mexican migrant who was a male, rural, middle age. Now, migration has changed dramatically, and one of the most important changes we have, and that's the reason because we need to adapt our programs, is that the whole family is moving. Now we have to deal more with women. 36% of migrants are women, and in many cases with kids, young kids. So we need to focus fully in this important objective, to try to work in the improvement of the quality of life of the whole migrant family. Second, we need to promote in parallel, full-time, paying the same level of attention to this to two purposes. The first one, to promote the integration of migrants to the country where they decided to live. No matter if it's the US or Spain or Argentina or Japan, wherever they decided to live, we need to be active promoting full integration of these people. It means to help them to learn the new language they need to deal with, to learn how the banking system works, the legal, the health, the educational system work. We need to promote actively full integration of the people to the destiny country. But at the same time, obviously, we need to promote permanent links with the country, with Mexico. We need to promote links, routes, and they need to be obviously, and they are proud of being Mexicans. We need to work once again in parallel, paying the same level of attention in these two directions, integration and linkage. And third, it's important, obviously, we need to help them to organize themselves in the best way they think have to organize. There are many different kinds of organizations. Every country in the world who has a diaspora knows that there are many different kinds of organizing themselves. It can be through religion, sports, social activities, entertainment, culture, arts, whatever, but we need to be very active trying to promote their own organization, free and strong organization. Those are three very important permanent objectives IME has to deal with on a daily basis. Well, what I was saying, this year is a very special year for IME. We need to remember that we have accumulated 20 years of experience and history, 13 as programa de atención a las comunidades mexicanas en el exterior, that spent 13 years of life, important. And then in 2003, once again in April, in 2003 with President Fox, Programa de Atención a Comunidades changed and became Instituto de los Mexicanos en el Exterior, who was an important change. Different reasons explain why we decided to transform this successful program into a new, completely different experience like IME, that I think it is also a successful experience. So the addition of 13 plus 7 made this 20 years, and that's the reason because I want to share with you achievements and strategic challenges. First one, IME is Mexico's channel of communication with its diaspora. Is a creator and handler of the wide range of care programs. There are something like 25 different programs IME has to manage and to coordinate. Second, IME has built a strong and a vital a key network between Mexico's government and its North American community. Third achievement, IME identifies and interacts intensively with leading activists and institutional players in North America. Individuals, corporations, institutions, whatever. Four, IME disseminates timely and useful information on programs and care services offered by federal and state governments as well as the private sector to its diaspora. Five, IME provides a stable and formal system of community representation in North America through the advisory board that both Aaron and Lorin mentioned. Six, IME generates a demands and community initiatives capture channel to multiple public and private entities. These recommendations that you were commenting, Lorin, that, well, typically are a lot. Seven, IME coordinates a network of community programs necessary for the binational community. Eight, IME is an instrument of foreign policy that is highly respected, especially in Latin America and the Caribbean. I think this is the case to mention that up to now, IME has signed bilateral agreements with Uruguay, Paraguay, Bolivia, and Ecuador. These four agreements are working properly, permanently, and now we are negotiating. Actually, 2 days ago, I had a very interesting meeting with the Brazilian ambassador to Mexico. The Brazilian government is really is following closely the Mexican experience, and we're on the way of negotiating this bilateral agreement. I was in Belize last week. We started also negotiating with Belize this same kind of agreement, and we're negotiating the same kind of agreement with Colombia and El Salvador. This is in America. And we started negotiating this also with Morocco. That's the only one up to now we have outside this continent. Now, IME contributes to dignify in Mexico the image of Mexicans living in the U.S. And 10, easy to say, difficult to accomplish, for those who are familiar with the with politics, with Mexican politics, 20 years of continuity. I think that's one of the secrets why the program and IME both together have been, in few years, very successful. Obviously, there have been some changes. I was precisely speaking about this. One thing is to speak about the program, the atención, and a different thing is to speak about IME. One of the main changes with IME, we have an advisory board. We try it to empower Mexican communities living in the U.S. I'm the 8th Director General of this program. Obviously, every person thinks in a different way. Among these 8 people, there were just one woman, Ambassador Melba Pria, who is now the Mexican ambassador to Indonesia. I'm the first one who is not born in Mexico City. All the 7 before me were born and raised in Mexico City. I think this is an interesting thing. And that's one, possibly one of the things that we have not spoken a lot, but I think we need to think a little bit. Why Mexico, a country with a tremendous long history, tradition of migration, started with a permanent program just 20 years ago? This is a very important question. There are several completely different hypotheses. I have my own. Migration was not a topic of the capital of the country. Migration was not part of the capital politics. Mexico, as you know, is a very centralized country. Speaking about politics, we are a very centralized country. We're not the only one, of course. But migration was not an interesting and important, it was an issue for the capital of the country. It was an important topic for central, western Mexico, and then other states, but it was not a real, real important issue in the capital. So I think that's one of the reasons that help us to explain why the federal government started working with this so late. Because one of the programs, I'm sure you are familiar with the 3x1 program, the state of Zacatecas started working with El 1x1 in 72, 20 years before the federal government. And I can continue quoting some examples of successful programs and experiences where the state government started working quite before the federal government. So those are the real, for us, the real achievements we have been able to accomplish in these 20 years. Let's speak about challenges, strategic challenges, looking at the long, medium, long term. This is the vision for the 2020-2025. First, to expand and diversify the network of public and private partnerships to design new programs, seeking always to ensure sustainability. One example, up to now, among the federal ministries, of course, the Ministry of Health, Education, and Social Development have been very active. But what about, for instance, the Ministry of Agriculture? What about the Ministry of Tourism? What about the Ministry of Foreign Trade, la Secretaría de Economía? What about the Ministry of Labor? We need to start working in new alliances and to start bridging with the idea of possible new programs dealing with new different topics. Second, to transform the current paradigm of community activists in a new, more prepared, committed, and representative community leadership model. One example, the average age of Mexicans living in Mexico, the 106 million Mexicans living in Mexico, the average age is 24 years. The average age of Mexicans living in the US is 27 years, so 3 years older. The average age of the three generations of the advisory board is 47 years. Something is wrong. Where are the young people? Where are young Mexicans? Those are the kind of things we need to think and to start to rethink how to deal, how to promote a different kind of leadership. Third, to promote the ongoing evaluation of the true impact of programs and services offered. These two papers help us a lot to evaluate continuously really the real impact of these programs. Fourth, to make progress in the study and knowledge of the history, structure, and profiles of the Mexican community abroad. We have been working actively in this, but we need to study more and in these kind of things. Once again, the MPI, these papers, and I'm sure many different institutions that are represented this morning can help us a lot. Five, to create a comprehensive system of information and dissemination that makes intensive use of technologies. Now we have several important different channels of information. Possibly some of you are subscribers of Lazos, this daily electronic newspaper we have. I don't know if you're familiar with this, otherwise if you want, it's in Spanish, well no, it's bilingual or even trilingual because we also cover some French news from Canada, from Quebec. And we have this kind of electronic newspapers, but we need to coordinate and to be able to set up an unique, integral, homogeneous system of information. Six, to update and expand educational opportunities to emerging segments of the community abroad. This is a key part of the new strategy, of the new challenges. For obvious reasons, we needed to focus on the elementary law education, law middle education. But what about these almost 1 million Mexicans who are knocking at the door of the higher education? The only binational program, Mexico-US, that we have now, you are familiar with this, is the Fulbright Garcia Robles programs, which is funded by both sides, both governments, with $1,200,000, a very low amount. But this is a different kind of program because this is fully devoted to Mexicans living in Mexico that want to come to the US. That's a completely different story. We need to create, to set up for the first time ever, a specific program for Mexicans living abroad in higher education. That's a real challenge. And we're not too close, but I think this year we will be able to announce important initiatives in this field. And the second one, you mentioned something around certification of labor skills. Why, if we are able to certify labor skills in Mexico for waiters, gardeners, breakers, plumbers, electricians, carpenters, etc., why we have not been able to certify these labor skills in the US? This is a matter, first of all, of self-esteem. It means a difference of income. When you get your certificate as a waiter, you will be able, very possibly, to increase your salary. And second, and third, we help to the mobility of these people. If it's the case, if one certified welder is deported or has to move from Oregon to Georgia, it makes a huge difference to have this certificate. So we need to increase and to expand this program. Seven, to strengthen the migrants' mental health care with the support of the effective and extensive existing infrastructure. I was speaking about these 42 health stations. All of them are very focused, very devoted, very committed on the, with the health of Mexicans, but not too much dealing with the mental health. This is a typical problem with migrants in every part of the world. We need to work stronger in this field. Eight, to ensure that the advisory council of IME begins a time of reflection, review, and reform. The council should be a more consultative, more constructive, and more representative one. Actually, this coming 12th of February, we will have the very first meeting with the coordinators of the 7 commissions of IME in order to start working slowly, gradually, but firmly into the transformation of this advisory board. 9, to develop a new public policy linking remittances to regional development and job creation. We have to be very frank. There are hundreds of villages in Mexico that started receiving these remittances 20, 30, 40 years ago, and these villages continue to be as poor as they were 30 years ago. It's important to work on the, well, decreasing of the commissions for sending money. We need to work on best, easier ways of transferring money to Mexico. But the real challenge is how to add value to these savings, how to connect savings with investment, how to create jobs. We need to create a completely new public policy. Actually, in May 6th and 7th of May with the Inter-American Development Bank, we will promote a regional summit on remittances in Mexico City. That will be the topic of this seminar. 10, to organize and systematically make the most of the variety and richness of talented Mexicans abroad. We need to set up networkings with successful Mexicans living abroad, academicians, scientists, sport people, art, culture, entertainment. These talented Mexicans can be a very important ally of the Mexican government and can help us a lot to promote these programs and to be a kind of speakers of these programs. 11, to globalize the programs and services offered by IME abroad. We're speaking about 11,700,000 Mexicans in the US, but what about the rest of Mexicans living in other countries who are almost 500,000? We need to be able to expand these programs. 12, to position the Mexican experience in the care of its diaspora as a key instrument of international cooperation policy. Believe me, speaking frankly, many countries, many governments could learn with the Mexican experience dealing with its diaspora. So we need to promote this as a key instrument of international cooperation policy, wherever we go. 12, to promote a better coordination of federal policies of community protection and community promotion of Mexicans abroad. You know, we have a long tradition of protecting human rights of Mexicans abroad, but sometimes we promote and we protect in not exactly in the in parallel paths. And last but not least, to be able to depend less on fiscal budgets through alliances with national and international foundations and the private sector. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you, Carlos, very much. I'm just going to take a very few minutes at the end of this panel to make a sort of coda on this really fairly comprehensive view of IME that we have gotten to elaborate on the point that Michael made at the beginning when he said that integration of diasporas in their countries of destination is a development issue as well as a political, social, welfare, foreign policy issue. There's a straw man in the sort of policy debate about diasporas, and that is the idea that integration and continuing engagement in the country of origin are somehow opposed to each other. The idea that people can't hold two kinds of attachment in their brains at the same time and that they have to choose. I mean, this has always seemed to me a little bit like saying, you know, you can't love your father and your husband at the same time. You have to sort of make a choice. But I think that more and more governments, both in origin and destination countries, are beginning to realize not only that this either-or concept doesn't match reality, but also that it's sort of damaging from a policy perspective, and indeed that integration and engagement of the diaspora go hand in hand. And I must say, without trying to flatter, that the government of Mexico was one of the first to understand this, although still fairly recently, 20 years, as Carlos said, and it's been evolving rapidly over that period, and also with a lot of pushing from Mexicans abroad and their descendants. A well-integrated diaspora conveys a number of advantages for the country of origin, and it's not just about remittances. I mean, remittances get sort of 90% of the attention to this topic. And although Mexico is, I think, the second largest receiver of remittances in the world, remittances actually form a very small portion of Mexico's gross domestic product, 2 or 3% at most. So it's not just about remittances. Diaspora members also invest in businesses in Mexico and in the United States. They buy bonds and stocks on the Mexican market. They're a very important source of philanthropic contributions in Mexico. And Carlos mentioned the famous three-for-one program through which Mexicans resident in the United States collectively contribute to public works projects in their communities of origin. They're also increasingly important in developing trade and business ties across the border and in transferring knowledge and skills across the border in both directions. So that, as I said, I think the program of IME shows an awareness of this relationship and a particularly sophisticated relationship. We have, in the Migration Development Program here at MPI, done a lot of looking at how governments try to interact with their diasporas, and I refer you to an excellent book edited by my colleague Dublin Agunias here, which really looks at the kind of institutions, and in fact there's a case study of IME by Carlos's predecessor as the head of IME. IME is sort of built on what was at the time of its origin, a very innovative concept that successful integration and empowerment of diasporas in the country of origin increases the ability and the inclination of the diaspora to contribute to the development of the home country. The services provided through IME to the Mexican diaspora in the U.S., which we've heard about, are not only useful to the individuals that that benefit from them, but they've also helped in the continuing work of creating a relationship of trust between the diaspora and the government. You know, there's that's a work in progress, and it probably always will be, but these programs have that impact as well as their direct impact. And the council that Laureen mentioned, Carlos also, the consultative council, is has not only a source of ideas for the government and a channel of communication, but has lots of room for disagreement. And I think that's also a sophisticated and fairly healthy and healthy development for governments to understand that they can disagree, that their diaspora may even oppose different actions, but that nonetheless the relationship is critically important. Carlos mentioned some of the particular programs. In addition to 3 for 1, the Mexican Talent Network is trying to pull in highly skilled Mexicans abroad to work more closely with counterparts in Mexico. The creation of the consular ID card has been extremely important from a development perspective because it allows Mexicans who don't have U.S. documents to open bank accounts, to get credit cards, to get loans, in other words, to be active agents of development of themselves, their communities, and ultimately the country as a whole. So there are a lot of these programs. I was very pleased to hear Carlos emphasize that these are among the strategic priorities of IME. The government of Mexico has long encouraged the Mexican immigrants to organize themselves, to federate their grassroots organizations into bigger organizations that can be more effective. And I think most importantly, the government of Mexico takes the long view. I think understanding that closer integration among the three North American states, in which this diaspora population plays a critical role, is the long-term development strategy for Mexico. That it's the future. Mexico is a middle-income country, after all. It's a middle-income country with a lot of poor people. But this idea of integrating with the neighbors is a long-term strategy, and a committed diaspora, a diaspora committed to Mexico, that also exercises increasing political power in the United States because it is well integrated, is an enormous asset for Mexico as well as for the United States. So, thank you.
Very nice, Kathleen. Well, we have a few minutes for questions. We'll start in the back. Thank you.
My name is Gilbert Cuevas. I come from California. I came specifically for this conference. I've been reading much of the work from MPI. Excellent work. But I think we're missing a very important area, and that is the demographic one. Since 2000, over 2 million white Americans have been dying. Only 300,000 births over deaths. From 2010 to 2020, I estimate, based on the age factor, that there will be about 24 to 25 million white Americans that will die out. In addition, by 2020, there will be 50 million reaching the age of retirement, and 90% of those are white. Now, if we think about it, the white population is the best educated. The PISA studies clearly show us that the white students here are well educated. They're comparable to the students in Europe. Their scores are better than the Japanese. The minority scores were the lowest. The Mexican scores were the lowest in 2003, 30th in 2003. In 2006, it was the lowest again. So we need to spend a great deal more attention on the education of the Latino population minorities, especially blacks and Latinos. If we don't, I suspect that we're going to have a divided nation again. And it could very easily lead to some very unpleasant activities. Now, I understand Mr. Garcia Alba is interested in getting the Mexican government involved in the education of the foreigners from Mexico. But I think that we should do everything in our power to help our Mexican-American students learn more about the democratic tradition of this country. From 1992 to 2000, I was the director of Future Leaders of America. It's a Latino youth leadership program based in California. And through a grant that we got during the Reagan era, we started doing some programs here in Washington, D.C. They were for Mexican students as well as Mexican-American students from California. The students from Mexico were the academic tens. They couldn't get into this program unless they had a 8 average. That was a minimum. The California students, again, were also college prep academic students. And I was struck by the fact that all of these students, these were college prep students in California and the highest academic students in Mexico, they knew nothing about government, especially those from Mexico. It appears that the Mexican schools do not want the students to learn about the political system.
Thank you. I think that's a very helpful comment. Do we have any other questions here? Yes.
I have a question. Thank you, everyone. How does the Mexican government, the U.S. government, these programs that are obviously very successful or have had successes in the past 20 years, how do they engage the diaspora groups and make sure that they're aware of the programs and able to fully take advantage of everything that you're offering?
Want to comment before?
Depends certainly on the program. So in the case of healthcare for the Ventanillas de Salud, they're actually right there in the consular station. So many times when someone will apply for a consular identification while waiting, often there'll be offices right there where they could get information about diabetes testing or healthcare centers. But you're right that there are challenges to outreach, particularly in rural areas. So it's to the extent that the U.S. consular network is performing outreach to more rural areas, that's really how the word gets out.
Well, both are very important and interesting remarks and questions. In the first case, well, one of the strategic challenges I quoted was to understand and to increase the knowledge of the structure, history, and profile of Mexicans abroad, which means certainly demographics. We need to know more. And I think both census in 2010, because this is a census year in the U.S., but it's also a census year in Mexico. And for the first time in the Mexican case, there will be some questions, including Mexicans abroad. This is a very important thing. For the first time, it will be included in the Mexican census, the diaspora. Not fully, but there are a few questions. So I fully agree. We need to know better demographics many times. Demographics are the base of successful programs. So I fully agree with this. Speaking about the kind of education, the content of education, well, we are obviously not those who decide what are the contents of education on the American side. But in the case of a Mexican side, yes, it was a mistake. For more than 20 years, we disappeared el libro de texto de civismo. In Mexico, those white Mexicans like me, we remember when we were attending elementary school, we have a specific book. Since the very first level of education, we started civismo, which means politics, the political system. But suddenly, I think it was the wrong decision. It's, more than 20 years ago, we decided to cancel this content. Now, fortunately, from this last year, 2009, we started learning and studying civismo.
That I think that was the right decision, and it will help in the right direction that you are mentioning, Mr. Gilberto. And obviously, the tremendous, unfortunately, permanent problem of dropping out. This is a tremendous challenge for everybody. This is a matter of parenthood, individual family education, but we need to continue working jointly to creating alliances, not excluding any possible way of convincing young Hispanic people, mainly Mexicans, that the best way to get a good job is to have to get a better and higher education, no doubt about this. And speaking about organization, well, we respect absolutely the way Mexicans decide to organize themselves. They are very, very well, very active in this field. We have many different kinds of clubs, associations, community workshops, many different kinds, and well, specifically for the Tres Por Uno program, they need to be organized formally as a club in order to get resources from the federal government. So there are many different ways of organizing themselves. We promote actively the organization, respecting obviously the way they organize, but how to inform, how to distribute the information of the IMES program, that's a real challenge, that's a real problem. We have accomplished just 2 weeks ago the very first integral evaluation of IME. Possibly some of you know Alexandra Delano, who is now working in New York. She was responsible of this evaluation, and one of the most important things she's informing, she's detecting, is that just something like 7% of Mexicans living in the U.S. know about the existence of IME. It's a very low percentage. It's a little bit better when we speak about the programs. More Mexicans know about IME's programs, but let's say the brand IME is very low known. In the case of programs that are more successful, like in the case of health, something like 40-42% of Mexicans know about the health programs. In the case of education, it's a little bit lower, it's something like 26-27%. So that's one more of the strategic challenges I propose, to have a comprehensive system of information. We need to include information in the waiting rooms of the Mexican consulates. We have a program, Saberes Poder. We have screens in up to now in something like 27 different consulates where we broadcast daily information about these programs. But we need also to use more the radio, TV. We need to include also mailing. Some people prefer this kind of information, first-hand mail information. And obviously, the website of IME has to be promoted more actively. So this is one of the challenges we have, how to inform better to the Mexican community about the programs. We can have very good programs, but if programs are not known, what is the case?
Douglas?
Leading the Women's Migration Policy Institute. I've looked at about 44 institutions like IME in other developing countries. And what I found is that one of the key determinants of success is the extent of the support at the destination. I was wondering, since we're talking off the record, how would you characterize the relationship of IME with the US government now, and how do you intend it in the near future?
I didn't know that 44 countries or governments have this kind of programs worldwide.
But
it's an interesting
information, because you are confirming, in other words, that very few governments in the world have permanent programs for their diasporas abroad. Mexico is one of those few cases, and possibly one of the best known cases, for the good and for the bad. This is a tremendous responsibility to have a program of the diasporas. Well, in the case of the relationship, obviously, we need to be completely respectful. When we implement, when we promote programs abroad, and not just in the case of the US, because again, one of the challenges is to globalize information and attention for Mexicans abroad everywhere, not just in the US. But obviously, in the case of the US, there is a different size of problems, and we promote all these programs in a different ways, in alliance with the counterparts. In the case of education, Aaron was telling you that we work in the educational programs with either the federal, the education department of the US, and in many cases, you have a very decentralized educational system. We work a lot, continuously, daily, with the state governments and in the school districts all over the US. So these programs are also successful, thanks to the fact that we have alliances and we work jointly with the American counterparts, and not just official. There are many also non-official counterparts and the private sector in the US. In IMEBECAS, for instance, we raise yearly money for IMEBECAS, for these plazas comunitarias. Fortunately, we have a very important support from the private, from the American private sector. So we work jointly with American counterparts, and obviously we respect the limits of and the rule of law in the U.S. We don't promote anything that goes against law, and we fully respect the rule of law of this country.
We take it as something of a matter of faith here at the Migration Policy Institute to end our meetings more or less on time, as we promised we would do. And so I would just like to take this opportunity to thank Lisa Dixon, who helped organize this excellent event. I would really like to thank our four presenters, who I thought each did a fabulous job. And I would in particular like to thank the ambassador, not just for coming and giving us a superb presentation, but for his guidance on this project as it's progressed. So with that, thank you for coming.